This is Kate Scott Allen of Otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This episode is being reported on April 10th, 2014, and today we are talking to Jackson Harper. We talked to Jackson a few years back when he was a .NET programmer. Today we're going to talk to him about a new project of his, Code Review, an iPad app for doing code reviews. So thanks for coming on, Jackson.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for having me. Yeah, so I think the background of the app is kind of from when I worked on Mono, like sort of the way that I learned to develop software. Like there was, when you're working in open source, it's kind of like this natural like code review flow, especially before GitHub when we had like CVS and you actually needed someone's permission to get your code checked in. So it was sort of the way that like I really learned how to program and something that I kind of missed. And then it just happened, another Mono developer, JB, he sort of missed that too. And so we decided to kind of collaborate on this and build this thing.
So why don't you give us a quick description of what exactly the app does?
Yeah, so right now it hooks up to GitHub. So it's for reviewing changes to GitHub code. I think in the future, hopefully there'll be other backends. So Bitbucket or you know, whatever you happen to use. It helps you triage the code. I think that's one of the places where it really helps. Like if you've got like a lot of changes coming in, it helps you kind of easily filter through them, see what's important, see what you have to follow up on, and then kind of keep a to-do list. And then it allows you to like comment on the change set in general. So just like commenting on a pull request, or you can comment on individual lines of code all right on your iPad.
So what does this add to the kind of, you know, I've used GitHub, like even just on my phone or, you know, I mean, on a mobile device, in the browser. And I'm sure you add quite a bit to that. How does it improve the experience over just kind of the mobile web browser experience?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that mobile experience wasn't there when we started. So that was one of the reasons, but still they don't really have an iPad specific view. Like if you go to GitHub on the iPad, you're going to get the desktop version. So we do a lot of stuff. You know, it's more touch oriented. And then one of the big things is it's very offline oriented. So when I sync a pull request, like when I see that you've got an open pull request, the app will download all the open commits associated with it, the diffs, all the comments. And, you know, that way you can get up, go on the train, you know, work through the things, add your comments. And then when you get back online, it'll post later.
So it supports working completely disconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think at my previous job, I worked a lot with physicians that were in the hospital, and I really learned like how terrible corporate Wi-Fi and hospital Wi-Fis are. And so I think pretty much every mobile application kind of really needs to work in like a completely disconnected manner to be usable. So that was like one of the very first things I did was sort of design it that way.
I just have to say, when you said like get off the train and stuff like that, I just assumed it was kind of a Git, like, you know, one of these Git methodologies, Git flow or GitHub flow. It was like a term, like you get off the train. So, you know.
Yeah. A lot of people kind of want me to create my own workflow. Like people don't really like GitHub calls it like the fork and pull workflow.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if I ever do, I'll use like train terminology.
There you go.
Obviously you're working against the GitHub APIs for this, I would assume.
Yeah. That was, it's something I still kind of debate. Like I could actually use Git, right? Like I could, you know, pull down everything via Git, but, it does use the GitHub APIs. It does seem like there's desire out there. I don't know if it's really useful, but it does seem like people have the desire to have like full code checkouts on their iPad. And I think the use case there is kind of like getting on the airplane and, maybe these people that travel with keyboards. But yeah, right now we're using the API. So we just we fetch commits and comments. They've got like a pretty nice REST API to work with, but we have like internally, it is kind of abstracted so that, you know, in theory, we could do the CodePlex version or the Garrett version someday.
Good. And that knocks one of our questions from Twitter off, from Chris Hardy. He asked if there would be a CodePlex version. So,
really? Really? Somebody actually wants
it? It was Chris Hardy. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was a, I can't tell. His avatar has kind of a semi-ironic smirk, but he's wearing Google Glass, but I don't know if that's ironic also. So it's really hard to tell.
Chris is really into his Google Glass. I thought it was ironic too, but he enjoys it.
He let me try it on last week at Build. It was kind of misaligned though for my eye. I couldn't really see it, and then I was kind of like noticed I was like kind of leaning into him, and it was So I'm curious. I mean, obvious question, but what are you developing against? Like, are you using Xamarin or Mono, or are you are you developing like direct native, or what's kind of your development stack?
So it is Objective-C, and then there's actually quite a bit of C in there too. The Markdown parser. I'll go off on a tangent here about the Markdown parser. GitHub, like, so Markdown's kind of a weird format where it isn't properly standardized or anything, and GitHub has probably been like extending Markdown more than anyone else. So to support all of these features, I had to use a really old open source C Markdown parser, which I believe GitHub kind of built all their extensions on, but their extensions aren't open source. So I had to build off of this old parser that was written in C and add things like task lists and usernames and a bunch of the things that GitHub's added. I think Markdown's gonna, like, in the next few years, I think the GitHub guys and the Stack Overflow guys, I'm pretty sure they're working together, and it's going to kind of get sorted out, and we're going to have like better standards for all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my tangent there on that.
So heavy string parsing in C, that sounds really fun.
You know, it wasn't too bad. There's definitely some like weird corner cases, like in terms of like, you know, the difference between a username and an email address, because they both have the at symbol, things like that. But you know, back in my Mono days, I swear I wrote like three or four different parsers. I was always like the guy that wound up writing parsers. So it was just like, you know, reliving those days. I also had to write a diff parser, because we parsed the unified diff format that comes down. And, you know, that's like a 20-year-old Unix format. And I thought it was going to be terrible, but it was really easy. It's funny, those old formats are so simple and clean. They're a lot easier than even dealing with things like JSON or XML.
Yeah, I was just parsing through a bunch of JSON today, and I was thinking, you know, it's not as easy. It could be easier.
Yeah, definitely. Like that sort of old Linux philosophy of just, you know, like line breaks, really kind of separating things and commas was pretty easy to work with.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obvious question is, you know, you have like a long history with Mono and Xamarin and stuff. Was there a reason that, like, are you just more productive in, you know, just working directly in C or and Objective-C, sorry?
No, it's not really anything against like Mono or the Xamarin tools or anything. Like part of the issue is like I did use it earlier on, so like I used it in the, like, you know, maybe the earlier stages where things weren't as good. But I think Xamarin is like a really good thing now. However, like my paying, you know, the way I earn money is writing Objective-C code as like a freelance developer, and that's, you know, what my clients want. And so it sort of behooves me to write as much Objective-C as possible and get better at it and, you know, become a better Objective-C programmer. And I do actually like it. Like, I know the syntax is really weird, especially coming from something like C#, and there's like some really ugly parts to it, but there's also kind of like an elegance to the language. The message parsing and kind of dynamicness of it, suits me really well. And I felt like sometimes with C#, I'd be like fighting the language a little bit too much, like, cause it would be so strict. But I think a lot of that too is like, as I've gotten older, I've realized there's not, you know, like one language that's better than the other. It's, you know, kind of personal preference.
Yeah. I felt back when I was playing around a little bit with Xamarin too, I felt like one of the challenges was I felt like I was going to have to learn to program iOS twice.
Yes.
Because they can't duplicate all of the Apple documentation. So like you had to go to those things and you had to like figure out how to translate that. So it seemed like a challenge from that regard.
Yeah, definitely. I actually just put in a proposal for a talk at the Monkey Space conference, and my talk was like how to read Objective-C for .NET developers for that reason, because there's, you know, so much documentation out there and open source and, you know, Stack Overflow answers that are useful to you if you're using Xamarin but are going to be written in Objective-C. But like I learned iOS by using Xamarin. So like I really did learn the APIs and how things work from using that platform, and it made the transition to Objective-C much easier.
Cool. All right, what is BetterFetch TM?
So this is you know how when you initially start writing an application, you kind of have some assumptions of how the user will use it. And you kind of look at the APIs and what's available to you, and you kind of build the best thing for that use case. And mm-hmm. then as you go along and you test and you use it more, the use case kind of changes, and often you forget to go back and like reevaluate the decisions you made at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically what it came down to is I was using the completely wrong GitHub API for fetching pull requests. So I had like, you know, this originally we had kind of conceived it as a stream, right? So it's more like a Twitter feed where, you know, there's just new stuff coming in all the time. But that's not really what you want. You want more like an email client, right? Where it's an inbox and stuff comes in and it stays there until you deal with it. And right. So I had originally built off of the stream API. I mean, it sounds really stupid to say out loud now, but originally that's what we built off of. And then, you know, we kind of converted it to this mailbox concept, but I never went back and like reevaluated the API usage. And, so then one day I did, and it turned out to be incredibly easy. Of course, the first thing I did is I kind of like sent an email to the GitHub API support explaining the problem. And then I looked at it more closely, and then I was like, oh, I'm so embarrassed, because the way their support works is I think, you know, everyone in the company can see your stupid questions. And so I was like, can someone please just delete that for me? So yeah, that was probably the number one issue was, you know, people were basically saying like, hey, I know I have a pull request on this repository that's still open. How come I can't see it in your app?
So what, I mean, one question with an app, what's your like business model pricing kind of stuff?
Yeah. So that's one place where, JB and I like worked together quite a bit. He didn't do any of the coding on the app. He had obviously a ton of input, but, he helped out quite a bit with this side of things. And we were looking at doing a freemium model. So it would be free for basically following GitHub's model where it's, you know, free for, public repositories, and then a monthly charge for, private repositories. I can't remember exactly what the dollar figure was. I think we were looking at around $1 a month, but you had to buy like in like 3, 9, or 12 month packages, something like that, 3, 6, 12.
Mm-hmm.
But as we got more feedback on the app, it became clear like this isn't for all GitHub users. This is for people that work in teams usually, and that use like the fork and pull workflow. Like obviously if you don't create pull requests, it's not going to be the most useful app to you. In the future, we will do like a version where it's kind of all commits coming in and then kind of flow through. But so yeah, it became much more of a business product, like business oriented customers, and they can't do in-app purchase as easily, right? Like if I was selling an app that did in-app purchase, each kind of customer would have to pull out their credit card and do it that way. But by doing a flat rate charge, we can do the volume purchasing plan stuff. So a business could just buy the app for, you know, all 20 employees that have an iPad. So I switched to a flat rate, and I haven't exactly come up with an exact number yet, but eventually it'll probably be around $20 to $25 for the app, but we'll probably start with an introductory price, especially because, you know, the 1.0 will come out and it doesn't have like every amazing feature that is in my head right now. So early adopters will get a nice discount.
So $20-$25 is pretty steep for an iPad app these days.
Yeah, it is. But I,
You know, it's, I just want to, I know it's uncomfortable. I'll give you a second to compose your thoughts. It sounds totally right for me, and I'll give you an example. Back when I was a heavy Android user, the one thing that didn't work well for me on my Android was Exchange integration. And I bought one app that was 25 bucks. I think it was 20 bucks. It was Touchdown for Android, and it was like, it was so awesome. Like, it was the best Exchange client I've used on any phone, any mobile device ever. And it was totally worth it. It transformed the way I used that phone and then the next one, right? Because I brought that along, you know, as I upgraded. And so, I mean, if it's something that people, like you're saying, it's a business app and something people use regularly, I don't, I mean, 20 does not seem crazy to me.
Yeah. And that is the other thing is, like, it is a perpetual license. I think, like, naturally, it's probably like 2 years, right? Because probably by the time iOS 9 or 10 or something comes out, it'll be at the point where it's like, okay, well, now we need to completely rewrite this app. But I think, A, you can charge a little bit more for the iPad than for the iPhone. I don't know why, but just because it's a bigger screen, people think it's more valuable. And B, like, the target market really is, like, businesses, you know, professional programmers that are going to save time and, you know, do their job better because of this product. So I think the value is there at $20. But yeah, you're right. Like, you're just so used to seeing like 99 cent apps or $4.99 apps. When we originally conceived it, we did talk about $4.99, but you know, you do the math and, it's hard to live off of $4.99 apps.
Well, and you know, also there's kind of the, like, I think you probably get a huge drop off when you go over a buck.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's the free drop off. There's like the huge cliff when you go from free on to, you know, one penny and then, or whatever the minimum price is, right? And then you go over a buck and then that goes over another cliff. And then after that, I bet the difference between $5 and $20 to a consumer is not, you know, then you're actually buying a product. You're not just like funny money on a phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to be able to offer good support. Like, and I want to be able to continue the development of the app. Like, you know, you download some of these apps and you pay 99 cents for them. And like, it just doesn't even start. Like, it crashes on startup where you can't log in or something. And you email the guy and they never reply. And, you know, that's kind of like a perfectly valid thing for them to do, right? Because it's just not worth the 99 cents to even reply to that email. So I do want it to be like a kind of sustainable thing. I don't think that I'll be able to live off of it by any means. But it'd be nice if it was a sustainable thing and I could justify putting more time into it.
Now, from a backend perspective, does it all run off of GitHub, or do you guys like have your own service component to it?
No, it's all run off of GitHub, and that was actually the kind of cool hack that I added today. Is I really wanted you know, like the nice background images you get in Twitter or Facebook. Like, you have your avatar image, but you also have a background image. So I was building like the profile view today, and it just looked so plain without one of those. So I added one in, and then what I did is I set it up. So if you create a repository named like code review data on your personal account, you can put the image in there and it'll just download it there. So there's no backend component at all. For a while, when I was doing the less ideal fetch mechanism, I really thought I was going to have to offload fetch to the server. And we were looking at doing it on Azure there. But it's one of those things where it's like, man, you're already after Apple takes their 30%, and you know, you're looking at $15. And then if you're paying like a few dollars a year per user to be running the server side stuff, it's not a very sustainable model. So I'm glad that I can get away without having any sort of backend. And also, iOS 7 added in some background fetching stuff. So I don't need to do anything like any server side fetching to generate push notifications.
Yeah, that seems smart. I mean, you know, people are going to, I mean, for especially GitHub specific code review, like, you know, people are going to have access and they'll probably have a paid account and they can just create a public one. Who cares for a profile, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a profile image. And it's kind of like, I don't know if it's a terrible hack or if it's an elegant hack, but I think it's pretty cool that if I add this repository to my account and you happen to have the app also. And even though if we're, you know, not connected in any way, if I, you know, comment on one of your pull requests and you tap on my name, you'll see my nice background image. And there's probably some other like possibly useful things that I could store on the server there. And if I do them in a readable format like JSON, then, you know, people might be able to either edit things there and have it sync with the app, or, you know, just get access to that data.
It's interesting. You've kind of almost created a, like a Retina Gravatar, right? I mean, it's a high quality Gravatar.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So this app is iOS 7 only, but the old, so it'll still support the old iPad mini and the iPad 2. So it, not everything is Retina, unfortunately, but, and these, it's pretty nice on these Retina screens. It's pretty nice to read code on them. Especially we got some good fonts in there. Like we got a good readable font for code. And we used a really nice font for the, all the comments and everything. So I actually enjoy using it.
So, in terms of like design, visual design, whatever, I mean, have you done all of that? Have you hired a designer to do any of the like fancy graphic stuff? How does that work?
Yeah, this will be another big mistake that I made is like the first thing I did was I hired a designer. He's a programmer that also designs. He does really good work, but at the time it was before iOS 7 had been launched. So we kind of, you know, iterated on some designs, and the day that we met and he kind of showed me like the final product was the day that iOS 7 was launched. So it was kind of like, well, let's just throw all of that away and, you know, start over from there. So after that, I moved on and I kind of decided like, hey, I'm going to do the design myself. Like I just can't afford to pay another designer. And, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a big challenge on the iPad because there's, you have like lots of like small snippets of text, you know, like just a little comment where someone says, you know, thumbs up or good job, and you know, this really wide screen. So it was a challenge to make things look nice. And I never really got things looking nice. And then one day I just saw one of my friends, you know, he had a friend that was a designer that was looking for some work, and he tweeted something and we hooked up and he sent me some mockups the next day. And, honestly, I hated them. Like I was like, I can't believe I just paid a designer again. And I hate this. Like I felt like I was going to cry. I've wasted all this money so far. And then he just made some subtle tweaks and I absolutely love it. Like, and, everyone seems to really like the design. Like that's the main compliment I get from people. So I think like designers have this ability to kind of like do something 90% and be able to see what the finished thing looks like. And, you know, programmers, we can't really envision their finished thing. So when they give us that 90% thing, you have to kind of like keep in mind that it's going to change a lot before it's done.
Now, does the styling of the visuals of the app sort of reflect GitHub in any way? Does it just try to incorporate sort of the GitHub aesthetic?
Not too much, I don't think. You know, it was definitely like, you know, it was there. And so it was a huge inspiration. And probably like some of the mistakes I made when I was trying to do design myself was probably following it too closely and kind of trying to follow like their iPhone design and make that look okay on the iPad. And that just didn't work at all. And then when Stefan, this new designer, came along, he was not even a programmer. So I thought, you know, originally I thought, hey, I need a designer that is a programmer so they kind of understand what's going on. And, you know, he was not a programmer, had barely heard of GitHub, and he did an amazing job. And maybe it's because he approached it with like a completely fresh state of mind and like no expectations on how things should work. We obviously like, I mean, we follow GitHub quite a bit. We do stray for some things. Like one thing that GitHub does is if you comment on a line of code in a diff, like say, you know, say I make a comment on a line of code in the diff and then you push, you know, another change. If that line of code kind of gets moved around too much or gets lost, the comment will get hidden. And so one thing we do is we like always keep those comments open. Cause I always found that with GitHub, you kind of like lose comments in there when the diffs are changing around a lot. And even though that line of code might be gone, it might be somebody saying like, you know, hey, we've got to go through and change all the white space from here on down.
And then you've got some cool stuff too with full screen as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So when we started on the app, that was right when Yahoo's mail client came out. And they were getting like kind of applauded for, I think they were one of the first apps that did like this, you know, like fully full screen, like get rid of the status bar, get rid of the navigation bar, get rid of everything. So it was something that I always wanted. And I just finally got to add in recently. And it makes a big difference, like just getting rid of all that stuff. It's quite a bit of screen real estate, first of all, like with our little toolbar on the bottom and then the navigation bar on the top. That's, you know, over 100 pixels right there. So you're kind of like reclaiming like 10% of your screen. So you get a lot more screen real estate, which is nice, but you also like just cut everything out. Like you know, you can completely focus on things, which is pretty nice.
So one obvious question, and Elijah Manor asked it, but it's been on my mind as well too, is do you use Code Review to review the code as you're working?
I do. Yeah. And like as an independent developer, it, you know, it kind of seems like a crazy thing, but like one of my inspirations for this product was Stephen King. So Stephen King, he talks about his writing process, and what he does is like in the morning, he sits down in front of the computer and he just like pounds it out as fast as he can. Like he just like gets everything into the computer. And then, you know, in the afternoon or the evening, he prints everything out. He goes into a different room and he does all his editing there. And that's like why he's such a prolific writer, I think, is because he has these like big contextual shifts where he's like completely focused on writing, just get everything out. And then, you know, having that mind shift. So I do the same thing where, you know, say you've got some new API that you want to try out, and you never like really structure things elegantly, right? Like you just write the most horrible code possible just to like get to the point where you can actually like invoke this function and get the thing back from the API and see what's going on. So I do try and work that way now, where I just like, you know, just let the code flow as much as possible and then come back later and refactor it and, you know, look at it with a fresh mind.
So that's fascinating and really hits home for me, because I get way too, and I've gotten worse at this over the years, I think, partly from working on books, where I'm always both reviewing or editing or whatever as I'm doing anything, writing code or writing blog post, writing book or whatever. And that really slows me down. And so hearing about like Stephen King doing this and, you know, thinking about like Hanselman had a good post on this recently about like just, you know, like getting, like you can get too much on your mind. Like as a junior programmer, it's like, hey, let's bang some code out and it all works. Awesome. And like the more you learn, it can kind of get in your way because you're thinking too much, you know, you're overthinking it. Do you have any tricks on like how this works for you? Like how you're able to kind of turn off that part of your brain and just go for it, you know?
Yeah, I definitely have that problem too. Like I work in a co-working space now, and a lot of times on the weekends, they have these hack fests in here where the people just like work for 48 hours straight. And I'm always like, man, that is so stupid. How could you write anything in 48 hours, right? Like I could barely, you know, set up my proper MVVM structure, my service layer and my database structure. Now, I think as programmers, as we get more experienced, we definitely, you know, we see more potential problems. So that's a problem. But I think we also, like, we put ourselves in that mindset more. Like we feel like everything has to be perfect right away and that we're being sloppy or unprofessional. But, you know, you can't say Stephen King is an unprofessional writer. Like you can say you don't like his books and stuff, but he's clearly a professional writer that does a lot of writing. So if he can use that process, there's no reason that we can't. We do need to make sure though that if we embrace the sloppy code, or not necessarily even sloppy, but just getting the code out of there as quickly as possible, we have to make sure that we embrace the coming back and, you know, refactoring and reviewing our code. But yeah, I don't have any particular tricks for ways that I can get myself in that mindset, other than just being like giving myself a small goal that I can work towards, like saying like, okay, I'm going to get this thing so that we can download and save commits. And, you know, I'm just going to get this working as fast as possible. I guess one trick I do have is sometimes so I always work on a laptop, and sometimes I don't bring my charger with me. So I've got like, it doesn't work as well now that I have the new MacBook, but on my older MacBook, it meant I had like 2.5 hours. You know, there's going to be no messing around on the internet. So first of all, it forces you to focus, but second of all, it like forces you to really accomplish your goal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a Pomodoro or something.
Exactly. Exactly.
I was thinking that was an advantage to having this on the iPad too, is there's a lot more focus on that form factor.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the iPad is really good for focus. I guess some companies have ad campaigns saying that's a bad thing, but, I think it's an awesome tool for focusing. Like I have all my push notifications and everything turned off on the iPad, and I use it for things where I focus for long periods of time, usually like, you know, reading or reviewing code or watching movies. So I don't jump around on the iPad like I do on the computer, or, you know, the phone is even worse, right? Where you refresh one app, quickly go to the other and refresh it and just go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there things that you could add in addition? Like I'm wondering as I'm, you know, if this becomes my main thing that I'm using for reviewing code, is there stuff over time? Like, could you, you know, summarize things or provide me like some intelligence on, you know, what's most important for me to look at next, or, you know what I mean? Like, tell me more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something like both JB and I were really excited about is, you know, this sort of like, you know, obviously he has the background working in CECL, you know, so doing like static analysis, but like, yeah, doing analysis on code, I think is going to become a really big thing. Like right now we do like analysis on bytecode kind of, but I think like stepping a level up and doing like more analysis on code, trying to find like hotspots, and then like trying to figure out like the overall impact of a patch. Like you can have a patch, using Mono as an example, you could have a patch to Mono that's one line of code, but it's like in the garbage collector, right? And someone like Miguel, who has like 50 programmers working for him, he's really, really going to want to know about that one line of code going into the garbage collector, even though there might be somebody else committing like 1,000 lines of code to Windows forms or something people don't use. So yeah, I think there's a ton we can do there, but it's probably out of my hands right now. I keep watching GitHub's career pages, not because I want to go work there, but I'm waiting for them to start hiring like lots of data scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know they're doing something similar.
Yeah, that reminds me of a joke. I'll try and see if I can get it right. A data scientist, an artificial language expert, and a cryptocurrency expert walk into a bar. Facebook buys the bar for $23 billion. But yeah, data science is like huge, and for good reason for this sort of thing, right? I mean, there's so much like, it's great to be able to like, I mean, a great tool that helps me review code day in, day out. That's gold. That's awesome. But then if there's some kind of intelligence on top of that that can do those sort of things like you're mentioning, say like, hey, this one line, you may be like, this needs to be punted up to somebody else. Like, this is important. You know, like that kind of stuff. And like you're saying, if GitHub's, it would be smart for GitHub to do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you can actually do it. Like, I don't think you have to be like a data science genius even to do it. Like, I think just going back to that example, just the fact that it's like the garbage collector file is good enough to say like, hey, this is an important change. So maybe someone like Miguel has to go through and like manually flag some things. But like the parser or whatever, like the intelligence doesn't have to be like, you know, like down to the if statement, at least for the, you know, the initial usage of this tool. But yeah, it would be awesome if someday we can like really, really analyze our code and figure out where things are going wrong, because we're just, you know, going to keep getting more and more code.
Yeah.
Be handy for the OpenSSL.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example, right? Like, it should almost be like anytime somebody commits something to OpenSSL, like everyone should be alerted and we should all go look at it. And you'd think maybe like the guys at Apple or, you know, the guys at Red Hat would be paying really close attention to things like that.
I'm sure they will now. So I'm curious too on that, like the idea of workflow or something. Like, so let's say I've got a bigger team and let's, you know, going back to the idea of Mono, like, so if you've got something where you can review some things, but you're like, hey, this is garbage collector. Like, that's a Miguel thing or whatever. Like, how do you, you know, do you have stuff now or do you have plans for how you'd work with a bigger, like, hierarchical team?
Yeah, and so that's something like people ask about a lot, is because there's a few different methodologies of code review. Like the most basic one would just be like sort of like a, I just call it like a stream, right? Where I just kind of I'm the lead programmer and I just kind of like pay attention to everyone's code as it comes in. So I'm just kind of watching the commits and reading them and making sure I know what's going on. And I think that's a like really valid way of doing things. Then sort of like the next phase is doing more of like the pull request type thing, where people are creating, forking repositories, creating a pull request, and then you have some rules on who's allowed to merge. Usually you have rules like two people have to review it and say, yes, this is okay. And then anyone can merge it. But on GitHub, there's not really like strict anything that really enforces that. So like the next level up is tools like Garrett, where, you know, somebody has to go in there and plus one the code and someone has to plus two it. And then someone has to say that they tested it and someone has to like say that they verified it and then it gets merged in. So a lot of companies think they really want that strict workflow. And, you know, definitely like as you get really big, it's something that seems ideal, but I think GitHub's kind of middle ground is pretty good. And like the way that this would work on Mono, right, is I kind of have my code, my areas of code, and I could commit to them and do whatever I want. But if I did, say, like track something down in the garbage collector and fix it myself, I wouldn't just commit that. Even though like there's no technical thing stopping me, like I've got like, you know, file permission to commit the change, I would, you know, send it to the mailing list and there would be a discussion. So GitHub kind of works out to be like that flow, right? Where if I did come along something that I think needed more review, I'd just open up a pull request and there would be discussion there. And I would let the person that kind of has ownership of that code merge it. I think someday I'll probably add support for some of these more strict tools like Garrett. I do think though that like those tools are kind of the tools that give code review a bad name, because you're just forced to review everyone's code. And I think it makes you just like look for things. And usually what you find are like spelling mistakes in comments or formatting things. You kind of like lose sight of like what the actual goal of code review is.
That was always the problem I had. I mean, I haven't really done formal code reviews in many years, but back years and years ago when we did them, it always seemed like the only thing people found were the trivial stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's some joke where it's like, you know, you submit a 5-line patch and you'll get like 50 comments on what you need to change, but you submit a 10,000-line patch and everyone will say, looks good to me, feel free to commit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I'm hoping that this tool will take us away from that a little bit.
What level are you at as far as like, do you have, are you shipping? Is it in beta? What, like, where's the product?
So it's in beta right now. There's still like some really cool features I want to implement, but I think I'm kind of just going to cut myself off. And like, as of probably Monday, it's going to be like, you know, feature lockdown, focus on bugs type beta. So I'm hoping that within like 2 to 3 weeks, I can submit to the App Store and I hope I don't get rejected. And so I'm hoping it will be out in like a month. The beta's been going pretty well. It betas are always hard because, you know, you get people that are not exactly your ideal customers using it and then giving you feedback and then, you know, wanting to feel like they're contributing. So they kind of want to see their feedback incorporated, but they might not be like the ideal use case because they're just happen to be like a friend or someone from the internet or something. So it's in beta and there's, you know, a bunch of people using it and maybe like half of them kind of meet the ideal use case and the other half don't. But it feels fairly stable. Like one nice thing is GitHub does have an Objective-C SDK. So I've been working with that. I did have to like add on to it quite a bit, but I do feel like having that and the fact that, you know, that code is well reviewed and everything, and that's good code, has kept the bug count fairly low. Like, most of the bugs I run into are really just like user interface related things.
And then do you have any kind of metrics or tracking or something so you can, you know, aside from just reports from users, you can tell what people are using or track, you know, exceptions or crashes or stuff?
Yeah, I do have crash reporting. And then I have some really basic metrics. I use it's a tool called Localytics, but I'm really wary about these things because, you know, the data in this application is so sensitive to people that I don't want to be like uploading a stack trace and it happens to include all of their code. But so yeah, I do get reports when there are crashes and I get a stack trace, but I don't get a memory dump. With Localytics, I do like the minimal amount of logging. Like, this is one of those tools where you can do really cool stuff, like, you know, see how people are moving through your app and, you know, basically see everything that's going on. But I really do just the minimum. Like, I log a message when they authenticate their account, and actually that's it. So I have an idea of like how many people have authenticated, and then I also get that because of the OAuth application statistics. But yeah, I don't have good insight into exactly how people are using the app, which is too bad. A lot of like the freelance work I do, we do a really good job of like seeing how users use the app and tweaking it. But with this app, I was just so afraid that I'd upload something sensitive accidentally, or just, you know, somebody would see that this app is like pinging this Localytics server, or, you know, this analytics server, and would be uncomfortable with it.
As a frequent beta user, one thing I would be happy if there was like a little checkbox in settings or something where it would say like extended analytics, and it said like, you know, allow this application to track, you know, more in-depth analytics. This may include personal information or all your code, or, you know, may sell your children on eBay. Like, and then I'll just say yes, because I love to beta test stuff, and then, yeah, you know, you're good.
Yeah, I just added RunScope to the app the other day. I had it turned off for release builds, but I was thinking about doing that exact same thing, where the way that I added RunScope is pretty cool, because of the way Objective-C works, it's easy for me to like hook in there and basically change like the URL for every request. So just by, you know, like hitting a flag, it makes everything go through RunScope, like everything in the app go through it. And so I use that a lot for debugging. It's a really cool tool. And I was thinking, if I did something like that, if I shipped it so people could optionally turn RunScope on, that would be really handy if I ever get into like one of these scenarios where like it's just crashing for someone and I have no idea why. I did early on. I had one of those scenarios, and luckily it was on a public repository. So the guy was just able to give me the link to the repository, and I was able to figure it out pretty quickly. But I think so far I've been pretty lucky in terms of like data interact, like bugs caused by like data interaction haven't really been a problem. It's more just been bugs, you know, related to the way the user interface works. So usually like those explanations you get from the user are good enough. And one nice thing too is because all my users are programmers, they'll give you pretty good explanations and sometimes even tell you how to fix the problem.
So I just have to, because some people may not know, about a year ago, RunScope is a service. John Sheehan was on the show a year ago, Herding Code 168, and he talked about that. And it's an API monitoring platform. And I was just thinking about them today. They just raised another $6 million Series A round. So congrats to them.
Yeah, it's a really cool tool. It's one of those tools that I didn't realize how useful it would be until like I actually went through the work to integrate it into the app. And like, honestly, I probably had like a four times performance increase because of it, because I realized like some calls were getting made too often. Like, so I was calling, like, you know, downloading stuff way too often, like the same data more than once. And then also I was messing up some of like the cache stuff. So I wasn't passing the correct cache headers sometimes. So again, I'd be downloading and redoing all sorts of stuff that I didn't have to. So just, you know, a few hours with RunScope made the app like significantly faster. And it was really good timing for me too, because I thought I was going to have to do all sorts of crazy performance things to, you know, get some extra performance out of the app, because it was starting to feel a little bit slow. And it turned out like I was just, you know, doing stuff too much. I didn't have to go make it faster. I just had to stop doing it too much.
You know, that's funny that the whole thing, like, it's great to work at a level of abstraction where you're not caring about the details too much, because otherwise you're stuck in, you know, like, you don't get much done. But on the other hand, like, exactly that point of, like, looking at, you know, the calls underneath the hood, when you profile things or when you look at that deeper level, you find all kinds of, like, scary stuff going on. Like, and that just reminds me, a few weeks ago, like, I checked in on the Herding Code site, and we're on a El Cheapo shared hoster still, and I've just have it like performance optimized like crazy and cached, you know, like, you know, for 3 years. But I noticed like our resource use is crazy. And then I started looking at the server logs, and oh my God, it scared the hell out of me. Like the stuff going on in the server logs, you know, and it's like just any web server, you look at the server logs, especially a WordPress server, but any web server, it's like the stuff that hits your web servers is insane. And we just don't think about it. So like monitoring at the API level is something I don't think anyone thinks about. Like you plunk around, you get an API to work, and then you think you're good.
Yeah, and it's just so obvious too when you use RunScope, because basically it just shows you like a big, you know, a list of all the API calls you're making. And it has a nice thing where it does like a green dot if it's a 200, and it does like an orange dot if it's a 304. So if you're seeing all green, it means you're not setting any cache stuff up properly. So it was like pretty obvious, and then, you know, you'll see the same URL multiple times in a row. So it's pretty obvious what's going on.
I just have to say, this is not paid commercial for RunScope.
I
just
I will. We have a funny story about the weblogs, though. I know probably like 8 years ago on Mono, it was the same thing. Like we had never looked at the weblogs, and then one day we went and looked at them. It was like the second most popular page, or, you know, resource on the site was like the logo. And so we were like trying to figure out like, why is everyone like going to this logo so much? And it turned out it was because like we were using Wiki software. And when you like clicked on like the download now image, like it was an image telling you to go download, it would like open up this thing. And so like we had no idea that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have been like trying to download by clicking on this image until we went and like looked at things at that resource level. And then it was so obvious what was going on.
In my case for this stupid thing, I just have to finish my story, but it was like crazy resources. They're going to kick us off the server, all this stuff. And then I noticed in the logs that there was a tight loop, like 10 times a second, there was a request for the RSS feed from Heroku, and it said user agent Ruby, and that was it. So it was Rob Connery, of course, and he was just screwing with us. I'm not sure it was Rob. I have my hunch. but so anyhow, I like wrote it, you know, abuse@Heroku.com. I'm like, here's the, you know, IPv6 address, like shut them off. And they did. And then like, whoop, you know, yeah, that was it.
So it was like a rival podcast.
It could have been. It might have been.
With you.
I think what's funny is we don't even host our RSS. It's over on FeedBurner. But like it was 302ing or 301ing to FeedBurner, but they weren't following it. Like it was just some script someone threw up on Heroku to just, I don't know what. And so, yeah, I just kept hitting it 10 times a second round the clock. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that script too is probably hitting like thousands of RSS feeds. So probably the next day somebody woke up and was like, wow, my server's a lot faster today. I wonder why.
Right, right. So what's next for you said you're wrapping up features and like finishing up beta period. Is that kind of the next goal?
Yeah. So I'm like cutting myself off. It's definitely the difficult part about independent development. Like I won't tell you when I expected to ship this app originally. Like I think originally I thought it was going to be like a 3 month thing, and I don't know how long it's been since iOS 7, but quite a while. So yeah, I'm like really cutting myself off now. I guess I did go overboard with the profile pictures and letting people download special headers, but yeah, we're cutting myself off, focusing on bugs, going to try and get it out there, going to try and get, you know, the real users, the people that are like really the target market using it, and then iterate on it from there and just kind of continuing to improve the thing.
Do you have like big vision things that you want to do down the road? Is this going to be more than just code review sometime at some point, or is it you're just going to like find, you know, refine the code review experience?
Yeah, at this point, I just want to get it done. No.
I'm sick of it. Get it out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I don't expect to live off of code review money. You know, like I want to be out there. I want it to be a good app. I want it to be a useful app. I think it's a small market. You know, first of all, like the number of programmers in the world is a small market. And then the number that use GitHub is smaller. And then the number that like use this workflow is significantly smaller. So I think it's a small market app, but you know, it's kind of my baby and I want to treat it well and let it grow up and then hopefully send it off to college someday. But yeah, I'll probably start working on other things once it's done. I still like most of my time is spent doing freelance work. I'm wrapping up like a freelance project right now and then I'll start looking for more freelance stuff.
You know, I was just reading this interesting article about a computer programmer turned politician who has put his entire platform, political platform, on GitHub, and people can comment on it by, like, you know, forking it and submitting pull requests.
Yeah, that's becoming really common, and it's an awesome way to work. Like, if you're dealing with, maybe accounting is not a good example, but like dealing with a lawyer, like drafting up some of the legal stuff that I had to do with this business, it's just, you know, emailing Word documents back and forth and like PDFs that are scanned images and everything. I was just thinking it would be so awesome if my lawyer was on GitHub and these documents were in Markdown and I could see her changes. So I think that's starting to become a thing, but you know, the tools are a long way off. I think for that to like really happen, you'd have to have something like a Word plugin that saves everything to Markdown automatically on GitHub. Word's always had like good change tracking anyway, so maybe Word's not the best example, but like that's what's really cool is being able to like see the changes, like especially with like political platforms, you can kind of see how he flip-flopped on things, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's completely interesting. I do a little bit, and I work with a lot of people at Microsoft that write technical articles, like big technical articles, and there's a lot of review, and then there's this like, you know, thing. Like, we always go back and forth. Like, do we do this in Markdown? That's so much easier. You know, it's closer to HTML. Or do we do it in Word? And there's like great review stuff there. And there's actually like better review and change tracking stuff in Word. But then the whole kind of like getting it to HTML thing is broken. It seems like there's a big, like, that could get better. I don't know what it is, but it's crazy that it's 2014 and it's still not like awesome. Like there isn't a great change tracking thing for Markdown.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I don't understand how all these other professions, how they even work without change tracking. Like it's just so fundamental to how we work, right? And it's crazy, like, you know, people are collaborating on PowerPoint documents right now and there's not good change tracking for that, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think they have folders full of a million different versions going back with time, yeah. You know, with dates in the file name.
Yeah, yeah. Final 01.
Final 01 for bill.zip.pdf.
Yeah, and I do know that GitHub is trying to address this. There was an article maybe like 6 months ago, and they talked about it a little bit, and they've been doing some of these new visualizers, I think are their first attempts at addressing it. Like they've been doing a lot of stuff with CSV, so you can visualize CSV better on the site, and you can post to forms on the site, and they're also doing mapping stuff. And I think that's because for the government, right? So that they can do, you know, change tracking on geo data.
Yeah. I don't know. I almost wonder at times, like SharePoint has gotten to the not horrible phase actually internally for me at Microsoft. Like it used to be when I had to go to something on Microsoft or on the SharePoint, I was just like, oh, this is going to suck. Like if you're using SharePoint, it's going to be awful. And it's gotten like the hosted SharePoint is by just nature kept up to date. And then it has like the viewers and the OneDrive stuff and all that. And I wonder if they'll do something at some point too, where it's like connect those two things of like the change tracking and the document versioning and all that, and like get it to that level. So somebody needs to.
Yeah, it's funny that like the people building this software rely on this sort of workflow, this change tracking workflow so much, you'd think we'd give it to everyone else because we know how useful it is.
It's a hard thing though. Like I remember as a very like day one programmer, it's like, okay, your code gets checked into this thing. What? You know? And it's like, so I'm checking it in and out and, you know, but like, I just think that's completely foreign to so many professions. And I don't, it's like you're saying, it's like, how do they even work? But on the other hand, nobody teaches it. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife is a physician and, you know, they have like Word documents on a shared drive and that's kind of how they work. And it's crazy.
And that's advanced.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. Hopefully it's backed up. I'm not going to ask, but I'm hoping it's backed up. Well, let me see. It's been a little over an hour. I think we had a few more questions, but they're basically like, who's the best Canadian you know and stuff like that.
Best
Any Canadian. Hockey questions?
Well, I'll start. Best Canadian has got to be Wayne Gretzky. Hockey related questions. Were there specific hockey questions that I could answer?
John. Actually, I don't see a hockey question. Is there a hockey question?
No, I was just asking. I don't know. Maybe Kelly would chime in.
What type of dog is my favorite? It's Labrador. When will I stop lying about my tweets? I don't know.
That's when. Hard.
Yeah, that's hard. I do this thing a lot where I'll tweet something and decide it was stupid and delete it. I think that might be what he's referring to there.
And you know, I've actually shifted. That's part of my workflow now. I'll like tweet something that's mildly funny, leave it up for a few hours, planning from the beginning. I'll tweet it, and they'll say like, I'll delete this in a couple hours. And it's like, you know, I mean, some tweets in the past have been like, oh, what was I thinking? And delete it. But like for the most part lately, like I'll just be like, yeah, I'll throw this up there for a few hours. And then others, it's like, oh no, this is a big thing. But you know.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this the other day. Is it would be cool if you could. I guess it's not A/B testing, but it's this thing like, you know, where Facebook has a new feature, how they release it to just a percentage of their users. So if you have a good tweet, but you know, you think it might be crossing a line or something, you could release it to a percentage of your followers and see the reaction and then maybe cut it off or send it to everyone else.
You can focus test your tweet.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think the way you do that is you put OH at the beginning of the tweet. That's how you deny all, you know, affiliation. You're pretending like someone else said it.
Exactly. Deleting
a tweet always seems to be, it feels the same as like recalling an email. You used to be able to have that option in exchange. But of course, by the time you did it, like everybody's read it anyways.
That's true, but it's crazy to me. Like, I'll tweet something, and like 2 weeks later, someone will retweet it. Or like 2 months later, someone will favorite a tweet. And it's like, how did you even find, like, was it on a web search? Like, how did you find that? So then I'm kind of like, okay, there's like the permanent thing that's floating out there that, I don't know, you know, the NSA is reading. And then there's like kind of my, you know, like, hey, here's a little thing for people that are up right now at 3 a.m. kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we might be overthinking Twitter a little.
Sounds like a new like professional level Twitter feature. Like if you pay, you can target your tweets to a certain demographic.
Exactly. You know,
Twitter
actually
gold account.
One interesting thing is like apparently it was like a really big technical challenge for them to handle deleted tweets. And I seem to remember there was a point like back in the day where they're really, really struggling, there was a point where they asked people to stop deleting tweets.
Wow.
Yeah, just because of the way that it's implemented.
There definitely was a thing where, like, for a while it was just completely like, how is this thing even working? And then over time, they, like, put some serious engineering effort into it. And, like, it's incredibly stable with huge growing traffic.
Yeah, it's funny. Like now Twitter is sort of like the status board for the internet, right? Like, so when GitHub goes down or, you know, these things that rarely go down, like.
Yeah. Or Heartbleed. Yeah, I mean, yeah, like it's where you find out about crazy, like breaking news kind of stuff. And it's always up.
Yeah. It's because people stopped deleting tweets.
And I'm ruining it. Here's a quick update. It is June 16, 2004, and I'm talking to Jackson right as I'm releasing the podcast. And since we talked, the app's gone live, right?
Yeah, it's been in the store for, I guess, a little over a month now. I've got managed to get a few bug fix updates in there. I think I fixed the last, like, embarrassing bug last week. So,
cool. And so the place to get this is at codereview.io, right?
Yes. Yeah, there's a little buy on the App Store button right there, and that'll take you right into the App Store.
Cool. And then you also have a blog on there where I guess you can – do you post stuff there, or is that mostly just people should see stuff on the App Store as the releases go out?
I think I'd like to start posting more on the blog now that kind of like the whirlwind of like fixing embarrassing bug fixes is past me. I'd like to kind of develop in the open. So as new features come out, I think I'll be blogging about them as they come out more often now.
Great. Okay. Anything else you'd like to say as we're wrapping up?
No, just, go buy the app if you want to buy it. And if you use it, please give me feedback. It helps make it better for everyone else.
Cool. Can you give us some downloads or something for our listeners?
Yeah. What we'll do is I'll send you 10 promo codes, and so the first 10 users that manage to make it to the show notes should get a free copy of the app.
Awesome. Okay, thanks a bunch, Jackson.
Thank you.